And as counsel are changing for the next case, this is the third of three oral arguments. File A250076 is next for us to consider. In re the City of St. Paul's decision on the need for an environmental impact statement for the proposed University of St. Thomas phased action. Chief Judge Frisch, Judge Eade, join me, Judge Sleater, on this third of three oral arguments that we have today. As a reminder, counsel, we are live streaming as well as recording these proceedings, so we do ask you to identify yourself at the beginning of your statements for the record and whom you represent. No other recording is allowed. We do also ask that you keep an eye on the podium clock as well. And then in the front face of the podium is an adjustment for the height of the podium to suit you, so we can still see you above the podium. And I understand from the letter that Ms. Schmiesing had filed that in terms of respondents, the City of St. Paul will argue first with 5 minutes and then 10 minutes for St. Thomas.
That's correct.
Very good. Thank you. Counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may approach, identify yourself, and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Daniel Kennedy. I represent Advocates for Responsible Development and its 300-plus members. We are here for the second time. This is the second environmental assessment worksheet that's been put forth by the City of St. Paul, drafted by consultants hired by the University of St. Thomas to address issues relating to UST's, St. Thomas's, development on its South Campus. There were three issues raised on the first appeal. The biggest one was the scope of the project, what the city was analyzing. They looked only at an arena, but there's so much more development that's going taking place on this campus. In the 35 years that St. Thomas has owned this, they have raised six buildings. They've remodeled three buildings. They've built six more buildings. Even since the last time, they announced a new building that they were constructing, which currently has a hole dug for it. All of this is part of a phased development by the University of St. Thomas on its South Campus, and all of this is subject to an environmental assessment worksheet as a phased action. The specific action that the court addressed last time was Schoenecker Hall, because that was so obvious. They were overlapping construction projects within about 100 feet of each other on the same campus, same owner.
Can I ask you, since we're talking about scope, about the scope of our review, I know that you've raised some issues that your colleagues on the other side have argued are outside the scope, and I wanted to ask you about these issues, the cumulative effects of the development, the rusty-patched bumblebee, the zoning and land use matters, including the ice rink refrigerants and soil standards, the building height, and then the setback area under the MRCCA. So my question is, all these issues were discussed in the 2023 assessment. So if the EAW in 2023, the only new information that I can tell between the 2024 EAW update and the 2023 has to do with the cumulative effects of the development, because they talked about microgrid and the St. Paul Seminary parking lot, and that wasn't in the 2023 EAW. But, you know, the rusty patch bumblebee that's there, all of the other issues are in the 2023. So how can it be that you can raise these issues now when you didn't raise them the first time? I mean, in the civil context, we have well-established case law on forfeiture of issues. Even in the criminal context, when someone's liberty interest is at stake, there are procedural bars for someone bringing up in later litigation issues that should have been raised or could have been raised earlier. So how is it that that these issues are now properly before us?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. When the Court of Appeals rejected the EAW, they rejected the entire EAW, not just the parts that had been addressed. The whole scope was open, meaning
the university... Is that really correct? I mean, I was on that first panel. It seems to me that the opinion had specific remand instructions, what the city was required to do on remand in three specific areas, that those were the identified deficiencies that needed to be remedied. And isn't our scope of review whether the city has complied with our remand instruction?
No, Your Honor, because it's a different document. It should have been, and the court required a new EAW. It wasn't stating fix these little things. It was stating you must fix these things, but it was remanding for a new EAW.
To address those three things.
To address the environmental effects of the project, and not just the project as St. Thomas defined it, but the whole project. And so when you're looking at that, you're looking at different emissions, you're looking at different effects on the Rusty Patch Bumblebee because it's different sites.
Are there different effects? I mean, the information about the zone for the Rusty Patch Bumblebee is the same. I mean, it's highlighted as exactly the same. The only difference in 2024 is that there is this expanded information from the DNR that's added to the 2024 EAW that wasn't in the 2023, but I mean the issue was there. I mean it's the same area. You haven't identified, at least that I can tell from your briefs, what the difference is and why this couldn't have been raised earlier in the litigation. It presents some concern because, this would seem to encourage litigants in this context to lay in the weeds on some issues and might lead one to believe that the goal was not actually to get an actual proper EAW, but simply to delay the project indefinitely. And I'm not saying that that's what you're doing on behalf of your client, but I'm just saying that from a procedural standpoint and in thinking about some of those rules and standards that we have in other contexts, it seems to me like, especially where the issues are exactly the same from 2023 to 2024, except for the cumulative effects, feel free to disagree with me on that if you read them differently, but I see all of those issues to be the same except for the addition of the microgrid and the St. Paul Seminary and the cumulative effects.
Your Honor, it is not ARD's responsibility to do this environmental assessment worksheet. The city has that responsibility, and when they do that, they have to do an EAW.
But it is your burden if you're challenging the EAW, right, to identify what the issues are. I mean, if those issues are exactly the same from the first EAW to the second EAW, I don't understand how they could properly be within the scope of review in this continued litigation that's come back to us for the second time on appeal.
Your Honor,
and you don't really cite any cases in your reply that I think affirmatively addresses how this wasn't forfeited.
Your Honor, we can't prejudge or pre-argue questions that we don't even know exist.
But you did know they exist because they were in the 2023 EAW.
We knew that they existed in that EAW, but that EAW got thrown out. And so they just...
Just to be clear, I don't read our previous opinion as throwing out the EAW. When I look at the remand instructions, they reverse a remand for a new EAW that considers the project and the Shenecker Center to be a phased action. We, on remand, the parking and traffic findings must address multiple stages of the phase project. And then we reverse a remand for a new EAW that considers the project and the Shenecker Center to be phased action. So very targeted, specific things that the city must consider in the new EAW, recognizing that the rest of the EAW and your challenges to the rest of the EAW were not reversible, or that the city was not required to take additional action. I mean, I think the concern that we have is we decide this case, say you prevail, they go back, the city has to do a new EAW on maybe one or two issues, and then there's another appeal, and five more issues are identified. And there has to be some end point as to what the scope of the issues are, so the city is not on this hamster wheel of continuing to prepare EAWs as new issues are identified. And where is that endpoint?
There are standards set out for every EAW, and every EAW must meet those standards. And so when the scope is expanded as it was, that can implicate lots of different issues. And we don't know and didn't know at the time how it would implicate all those issues.
When you say the scope is expanded, I mean, it's still an EAW regarding building the event center. It's just the scope was expanded in part to deal with the fact that on remand, Cheneker, as part of a phased action, had to be considered. And then the city undertook to make sure it's, one might look at the record and say the city wanted to make sure it covered all its bases. So it looked at the St. Paul Seminary, included microgrid, and addressed these issues in a more fulsome manner. So, I mean, even if we were to construe the opinion as sending it back for a new EAW, it's still the same project. It's just about how the EAW analyzes that issue, right? I mean, so maybe you can address how these issues can fall within the scope of review when it's the same project and the same issues were identified in the first EAW.
Well, you can talk about the various elements that we raise. Suddenly now, instead of one building above 40 feet, you're looking at several buildings of 40 feet, above 40 feet, and how is that, that's just changed from the first EAW. If you're only looking at the arena, now you're looking at Cheneker, which is 65 feet.
But you didn't even challenge the building height in the first challenge that came before us, right? I mean, the building height issue and the CUP, that wasn't argued.
It wasn't argued, but it's also a different scope of what you're of the environmental impact. Now you are addressing a bigger environmental impact. They might have said, well, for this particular issue, it's not a big deal. But now, instead of disturbing one site, we're disturbing three sites, and that has different effects on the erosion and the bumblebee that than just one project would be. And so. We don't know how they will address those on remand. Things change. They're not required to only comply with the court's order. They're required to produce a satisfactory EAW each and every time. And so each and every time that they fail is a new set of facts that may lead to arguments, or maybe it doesn't. But we don't know, and we can't say how they're going to address issues until they address them.
What's your best authority for that proposition, that the scope of review or this a second EAW can be expanded beyond the remand instructions from this court?
I don't think we are expanding, Your Honor. I think yes, you're right when you cite a specific example saying you must remand, you must do a new EAW for this purpose. That does not limit it necessarily for this purpose, because there are other citations that say we remand for a new EAW without limitation as to what you're addressing.
How do you reconcile? You've also argued that this wasn't a new EAW, it was just an update. How do you reconcile those two arguments?
That's just a fabrication by the city. It has to be a new EAW to comply with the environmental requirements, the environmental review requirements. They just called it something different by photocopy.
Well, it's on an EAW form, right? I mean, it goes through all of the same exact factors that the 2023 EAW did, right?
Exactly. So it is a new EAW. They're just calling it something different to make it seem like it complies with your arguments, to say, oh, you can't look at that part, even though that's required as part of our new EAW, because that's from before. So they didn't change that on purpose so that you would raise and they could raise the same argument to say you can only address what's in the update and not what's in the EAW, even though the entire EAW must comply with the environmental regulations.
Can I just ask a substantive question about one of the concerns that I think we had in the first appeal, which was the traffic mitigation measures? It seems to me, when I'm looking at the new EAW, there's a pretty well-developed event management plan, in addition to some other infrastructure components that are going to be adopted by the university. But there are 11 mandatory components to that event management plan in order to mitigate traffic, the traffic issues that have been identified. Why is that? What else are they required to do under the law? What other level of specificity is required to satisfy the baseline for whether an environmental impact statement is needed?
Thank you for that question, Your Honor. And I'm going to exceed my 1 minute left in responding. I'm sorry about that.
That's fine. You answer.
The mitigation measures are basically maybe baby measures, meaning maybe we'll do them. We're not required to do most of them. We're required to continue talking with the Metropolitan Council and Allianz Stadium and Uber and Lyft, but we've been doing that for 2 years without resolution, and all that we're required to do is talk to them. So we're not actually required to implement anything regarding those. And if we do anything, which we're not required to do, it will be small, meaning it will not have any effect because we already assumed that people will take the bus and people will take Uber to the arena, and so you won't see any effect. If we do anything, you won't be able to enforce it either because we're saying that these things are going to sunset, such as the standing room only limit that expires after 5 years. The zoning administrator will have discretion to oversee us. There's nothing in the city code allowing that, and nothing in the city code allowing the zoning administrator to make any change in the event management plan, which, by the way, does not exist yet. So there is no event management plan at this time or at the time of the writing of this 2024 update. And so we don't know what that EMP is going to do, but we know that it can't really be enforced because the city code doesn't allow the zoning administrator to do anything if we violate it. It's not part, notably, of the conditional use permit. There is a conditional use permit, but these elements are not in the conditional use permit. That would be one way that it could be enforced, besides leaving it up to the discretion of an administrator. So these mitigation strategies remain failures in terms of the specific targeted and certain to be effective standard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Council, and you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Council for the City, you'll have 5 minutes to begin. When you're ready, you may identify yourself and begin.
May it please the Court, Council. My name is Daniel Staley. I'm an assistant St. Paul City Attorney. You're correct, we're here on remand. We were here previously about a year ago. Since that time, the RGU didn't appeal its decision. It simply chose to get right back to the drawing board and to redo its EAW, and it followed the simple instructions that the Court of Appeals laid out last time. The Court had three issues for us to address, and we addressed all three of those issues. The first was to review greenhouse gas emissions for vehicles attending events, to review the impact of the Schoenecker Center, and to review whether the mitigation is specific, targeted, and certain. I think it's important to look at the standard of review here. In this case,
before you do, Council, how would you respond to Mr. Kennedy's point that there's no way to enforce these mitigation standards?
Yeah, part of the event management plan that's part of this entire approval says that the certificate of occupancy is tied to compliance with these issues and additional issues that may arise later. There is a city ordinance that allows the zoning administrator to make that analysis. It's in my brief. I thought I wrote it down.
Well, that's fine. I don't want to take up your short time already, but your point being is you disagree with that representation. There is no authority for it to be enforced.
Yes, it's part of the event management plan. Part of our ongoing regulatory authority is to be able to oversee traffic and parking issues, work with the university. They have to report back to us for a couple of years, and we can update mitigation as may be necessary, just kind of based on the circumstances.
Can I ask you a question? Assuming we get to the merits of the MRCCA setback argument, I see that in the 2024 UAW, in the section discussing that, it ends with, per the rules, St. Paul's existing MRCCA ordinance, which refers to the area where the project is located, must remain in effect until the new MRCCA zoning is formally adopted by the city. It doesn't seem like there's a dispute that the new MRCCA zoning is required by law. I think everybody's in agreement with that. The city just hasn't done it yet. So why shouldn't we conclude that, you know, the fact that the city isn't applying what everyone seems to agree should be the law in the city under the MRCCA is an error of law or evidence that this is arbitrary and capricious because the city relied on factors not intended by the legislature or didn't consider an important aspect of the problem. I mean, my concern is that at some point in the future, the city will adopt the new MRCCA standards, and then under that scenario, this would not be allowed to be that close to the Mississippi. And so maybe you can help me with that.
Yeah, the legislature allows municipalities certain time to update their ordinances, and it has additional time to do that. It hasn't done that yet, and there isn't a specific timeline in place required by the state statute. I believe on the merits of the issue, I mean, we didn't brief it or address it, but I believe that this whole project is is completely outside of the buffer zone, except for possibly a few inches of sidewalk. And we're talking about, so I think our argument in the event that it would change is that areas like sidewalks and paths don't count for that border area. I think that, I wasn't prepared to discuss that today because it isn't part of the scope of review. But, to my understanding, I think there's maybe about 6 inches of pathway that may have been in that buffer zone. And our analysis and our argument is that pathways don't count as buildings. It has to be a vertical structure.
Council, I want to just return your attention to the event management plan.
Yeah.
So there's an 11-part component. Your representation to us today is that the certificate of occupancy is contingent upon fulfillment of those 11 components of the event management plan. In the event that those components are not fulfilled after the certificate of occupancy is issued, and the appellants here are, the relators here are, complain about that, what's their remedy?
Sure. If there is a violation, ultimately the zoning administrator has the ability to revoke that, revoke the certificate of occupancy. That would go through a...
And if it chose not to do so, what's their remedy?
It's the RGU's discretion as to whether or not they're... So, I mean, we have the ongoing regulatory authority. If people make complaints, we would look into those complaints and determine if there's a violation.
I mean, I think that their argument, and I'm sorry I'm exceeding the time.
That's fine. Feel free to answer.
I think their argument is that the 11-point event management plan is in name only, and it's never going to be implemented. And their only opportunity to object is now, at this point in time. Is there some other avenue that, say we say the EAW is sufficient, say that that there's this 11-point management plan is specific enough, the certificate of occupancy issues, it turns out that not a one of these things has ever been implemented. What happens then?
We will not allow it to open. We will not grant the certificate of occupancy until they have been complied with. That's our representation today, is that these are requirements. These aren't suggestions. these will all be implemented before we allow. The certificate of occupancy has not been granted yet, and it will not be granted until all of these conditions are met.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. And Council for St. Thomas, you will now have 10 minutes.
Good morning, and may it please the court and council. My name is Betsy Schmiesing, and I'm representing the University of St. Thomas today. The court should affirm the City of St. Paul's decision as the RGU to not require an environmental impact statement for the Lee and Penny Anderson Arena, a multi-purpose sports facility on the University of St. Thomas campus that will seat between 4,000 to 5,500 fans and is designed to meet LEED Silver designation requirements. As you're all aware, the court previously directed the city to prepare a new or revised EAW to address three deficiencies with respect to the original EAW. First, to include impacts from the Scheneker Center, a new academic building on campus, as a phased action. Second, to consider the impacts of greenhouse gas emissions from spectator traffic associated with travel to and from the arena. And third, to provide for mitigation measures that were targeted, specific, and certain, and that were subject to ongoing regulatory authority. The city has fully addressed each of these issues through robust analysis in the 2024 EAW update and the 2024 EAW update transportation analysis addendum, along with imposition of those targeted, specific, and certain mitigation measures as a condition of and subject to ongoing enforcement pursuant to the project site plan and certificate of occupancy.
Have the 11-point event management plan components been put into place?
They are being currently worked on, but I will say that the required elements must be in place before the certificate of occupancy can be issued. And what that means is, like, let's use, for example, the requirement that there be contracts for off-site parking. The university understands that it has to have contracts, and those contracts have to be in place before the certificate of occupancy will be issued.
One of the things that makes me a little uneasy is that the first time you were here, we said to the extent that issuing a certificate of occupancy is regulatory oversight, it is different from ongoing regulatory oversight or the ongoing regulatory oversight described in the applicable law. Although, you know, we did later say the certificate of occupancy cannot be compared to permitting requirements and does not provide ongoing regulatory authority without additional evidence or findings by the city. And I know that you've highlighted that in your briefing. The thing I'm uneasy about is it one way of looking at the 2024 EAW is that all of the shoulds in the mitigation were turned to wills, and we still are relying on the certificate of occupancy. So maybe you can address that, because I think Chief Judge Frisch's question is going to that. You know, we don't have a record, and even as you stand here to say it today, it's, I mean, one of the most concrete things, it seemed to me, was talking to Allianz Field about using their facility and then running a shuttle from there, but even that wasn't, I think, nailed down as far as I could tell. So maybe you can address that.
Sure. So that's not nailed down, but there are other things that the university will be doing. For example, they are going to restrict the ability to have campus events that are going to attract more than 75 outside attendees on the times that those larger sporting events occur. Looking at my list here. They're going to implement modification of on-campus permits and parking restrictions. Some of these are, you know, pursue partnerships because they can't force anybody to enter into a partnership with them, but they are working on those in good faith. They are going to be doing all sorts. They're not selling standing room tickets, which addresses ARD's concern about larger events. So there are a lot of concrete things that can and will be done before that certificate of occupancy is issued. As to enforcement, the AMP is a condition of both the site plan and the certificate of occupancy, and these are not one-and-done approvals. The court asked for additional findings. The city made those additional findings, and that is in the record of this matter. The certificate of occupancy, the city's legislative code provides that a certificate of occupancy constitutes a certification of zoning compliance, and that's under St. Paul Legislative Code Section 61.102. And that failure to comply with any condition of a zoning determination or other zoning approval may result in revocation or modification of such approval.
By the city?
Yes.
Right.
That's
so,
correct.
I mean, that sounded what the city's argument
yeah.
was, but what can ARD do? And I think that, you know, the chief judge was asking that earlier. So say everything, the mitigation plan sounds nice, but the certificate of occupancy is issued and none of those actual plans are come to fruition. And so can ARD ask for injunctive relief in their ongoing lawsuit in Ramsey County? Can they add that to a declaratory relief claim? And does the law allow them to then force the city to revoke the certificate of occupancy?
I think that is something that they could add to their existing lawsuit. I think they could also perhaps ask for a writ of mandamus. I think there are a lot of avenues that ARD could take in the event that the city does allow the certificate of occupancy to go forward without having that EMP in place. But that doesn't mean it's not ongoing regulatory authority. Judge Eade, what you're asking about is what if the city doesn't on its own do what it's supposed to do with respect to enforcing this. And I think that's a separate issue as to whether or not this is subject to ongoing regulatory authority.
I mean, I ask it because of where I started earlier, because of the language of the opinion in the last time you were here and the concerns that a certificate of occupancy is not regulatory oversight. And so what the difference is now.
Well, I believe we've added citations, and the city has made a finding that this does constitute ongoing regulatory oversight. My view of the first opinion was not that it said that this can never constitute regulatory oversight. It's just said we don't have enough in the record. We don't know enough to say yay or nay whether this is. I'll also point out that this is a condition of the site plan as well, which is another enforceable zoning certification that can be revoked. Finally, the findings themselves give the zoning administrator a lot of authority with respect to the EMP. You know, if these things don't come to fruition or they don't, for some reason, have the effects that are needed, the zoning administrator has the ability to modify this EMP to bring in effective measures and alter the EMP to make this work. There's going to be reporting for 5 years as to the efficacy of the EMP. And
I want to address the concerns raised by your colleague on the other side about that five-year sunset and what effect, if any, that should have on our analysis.
Well, the zoning administrator has the authority to extend that. And certainly ARD, residents of the city of St. Paul, can communicate with the zoning administrator as to how that's going. I also understand that the university and the city will be working in conjunction with the neighborhood groups that are impacted by this, and we'll be getting feedback on the effectiveness of these measures.
Do you want to address the question I asked about the MRCCA and the setback and the fact that the ordinance hasn't been updated yet, whether that should be concerned if we get there and it's not outside the scope of review?
Well, I agree with my colleague from the city's analysis of the merits of the issue, but I will also say that this case is about whether or not an EIS should be prepared. And that is the only issue, or the sufficiency of the EAW under MEPA before this court. The issue that was raised with respect to the bluff line setback, that is a live issue in a pending lawsuit in Ramsey County District Court and can't, I don't think, be litigated in this court at the same time. I also, as I said, believe it's outside the scope of this matter. But I agree with Mr. Staley's analysis of the merits here. And also, as to the time and when the city, I don't believe there is a time limit on when the city has to finalize those new regulations.
And is part of the reason for your, asking us to defer to the lawsuit on that issue because it's essentially the request is that we are hearing a claim that's essentially about a legislative act of the City Council, whether or not to adopt the updated MRCCA ordinance.
I think that's true, Your Honor. I mean, it's just not within the scope of this lawsuit.
Because the statute seems to commit that to the discretion of the district court rather than an cert appeal.
I agree that that is outside the scope of this Minnesota Environmental Policy Act matter. I'd like to also just briefly mention the St. Paul Seminary parking lot.
Well, your time has expired, but I'll let you briefly respond because we haven't heard
about
that.
I just wanted to, since Mr. Thuroff is not appearing, I want to point out that the St. Paul Seminary should not have been dragged in as a respondent here. The St. Paul Seminary and St. Thomas are separate entities. The seminary is not the proposer of the arena project, and St. Thomas is not the proposer of the parking lot. And so the seminary's proposed parking lot is not subject to any form of environmental review by itself and is not part of the project under review because it is not a phased action with respect to the arena. So while the EAW did analyze potential impacts associated with a proposed parking lot, because of the proximity of it to the arena, it's not a phased action and should not be impacted by this law, this litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you now have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you. Some of these will be short comments. Again, there is no EMP. Nothing on the horizon. And even if one is enacted, it's left up to the discretion of the zoning administrator to take any action if there is a violation. But violations are going to be hard because some of these things just say that St. Thomas has to talk to people. It doesn't say that they have to do anything. So that's not a real requirement. There is no requirement, as Ms. Schmiesing asserted there was, to come up with parking contracts. All they have to do is talk about parking contracts. They can go ahead. One of the requirements is that they force their faculty and staff to park in the neighborhood so that they can free up their own lots for attendees of events. That doesn't do anything to mitigate the problem. That just shifts people around.
Isn't there some discretion inherent in every instance of ongoing regulatory authority? I mean, you point to the fact that the zoning administrator is the person overseeing this. Wouldn't that be common to every situation? I mean, how could there ever be any ongoing regulatory authority that would be sufficient for mitigation purposes if, does it require bright line rules that there's, you know, it's a strict liability type situation?
There's a huge difference between choosing when and how to enforce a measure and being able to create the measure that you are enforcing. In this case, the EMP, the mitigation measures, give the zoning administrator the power to create the requirement. So let's say after 5 years, the zoning administrator can extend or not extend, depending on their whims or whether they used to work for St. Thomas's point person, as they did at the planning department, to decide what the requirement is going to be. That's not a standard at all. How can we appeal that? There's nothing to appeal because it's somebody's decision. Putting it in a conditional use permit is different. So that kind of requirement does have teeth, and people can enforce that. But certainly not saying that the zoning administrator is going to make things up as he goes along to find out what the requirements are going to be. 5 years, by the way, is nothing in terms of this neighborhood. People don't plan to move after 5 years. They just are going to live through it and then see what happens after 5 years. This requirement of limiting events with 75 attendees means nothing because it only applies to people who aren't St. Thomas students or faculty, but they all drive in anyway, not all the students. Two-thirds of the students drive in. And so they should be included, too, in the impact of such an event. The issue about the bluff line, I'll mention because it was raised. that has two different elements. One is, can they build within the bluff line? The other is, what is the environmental effect if they do build within the bluff line? And that second aspect is pertinent to this discussion. That should have been part of the environmental assessment worksheet, and it wasn't. It's the same thing with the height requirement. It may be a full stop, but if it's not a full stop, what are the environmental impacts of exceeding a designated height that's an environmental measure in the MCCRA, MRCCA, and that should be addressed in the EAW. We are asking that the court do two things regarding the use of the stadium. First, we're asking that the construction be stopped until there is effective environmental review, and we're asking that that environmental review be in EIS. That does two things. First, it stops the further environmental damage that the construction is causing, but it also stops the usage, which implies different environmental effects of parking and greenhouse gases and traffic and other elements that are dependent on the users, not just the construction. We are asking that the court, for any further environmental review, send this to the Environmental Quality Board and have them determine who the RGU should be. Several members of the board wanted to choose a different RGU, but the court had specifically remanded to the city, and so they felt kind of stuck. But it's really an EQB decision as to how this is going to take place.
What's our authority to designate the RGU?
The EQB always has authority to designate the RGU.
No, but what's our authority to say the city can't designate its own RGU?
The EQB can designate. I think just language saying that the EQB can.
You're asking us to say, New City, you can't be the responsible government unit anymore. We want the Court of Appeals to send it someplace else.
What's
our authority to do that?
I think just sending it to the EQB and saying they should designate an RGU based on who they think is most competent, I think that would be justified.
I mean, and, I understand the argument that that's what you want, but what's our. I mean, we don't get to do whatever we want, contrary to popular belief. We have to do things that are directed by statute or common law, or a rule. So what is our authority to send it over there?
Thank you. And I'd ask for a little bit of additional time to respond.
Yes, you may answer.
Okay. The city is acting on behalf of the Environmental Quality Board in doing that. They are the designee of the EQB to prepare this report. But it's ultimately published by the EQB, by the Environmental Quality Board, and so they are ultimately responsible for it. So sending it back either for EIS or EAW, any environmental review, it should be the EQB who makes that decision. As long as the decision that comes from this court leaves at least that possibility open and does not specifically state that the city should make this environmental review, that would be helpful and allow them to make that determination. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today as well as your briefing. We now take the matter under advisement. We'll issue a ruling within 90 days. You all have a good day, and we'll be adjourning to consider our balance of our calendar.